Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod, where On Point News analyst Jack Beattie combines history, politics, and literature to give us his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, we're at episode 29. Today's headline, Jack.
How it looks to a Republican.
What is the it?
Donald Trump's extensive legal jeopardy. You know, jury selection in the New York hush money case begins Monday, ahead of what would be the first criminal prosecution of a former president. We're going to look today at the questions raised by Trump and his supporters. The key question really is, are these prosecutions political?
Okay, so walk us through a little bit of what some of Trump's closest supporters say, or even people in his inner circle.
Well, let me just give you a taste of this. This would be from Sarah Isgur, a former spokesperson for the Trump Justice Department and a columnist for the Dispatch now. I suppose she's not a Trumper anymore, but she does list what Republicans think about these prosecutions. She says they think of them as lawfare, and they point to these sorts of political colorations around them. For example, Alvin Bragg, who is bringing the prosecution, the hush money prosecution against Trump, he's the Manhattan DA, he attacked Trump during the campaign as lawless, his campaign for reelection, and vowed to hold him to account. In other words, he made a political promise, elect me and I'll go after Trump. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, in her 2018 campaign, she said she vowed to pursue Trump as, quote, an illegitimate president. Even President Biden has sounded somewhat political, Sarah Isgur says, when he was quoted in a recent Times piece complaining that Merrick Garland hadn't, you know, forced Jack Smith's pace so that the Trump cases, federal cases, could be resolved before the election. Well, of course, before the election means that he's worried about the political consequences. And then she looks at some of the charges these various venues and people are bringing. Bragg's case, for example, 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 hush money payment to an adult film actress. And there are lies in business records, and essentially they're sort of misdemeanors. And Bragg makes them bigger than that and criminal felonies by saying they also may violate another statute. He doesn't say what statute. He doesn't say what that is. Presumably it's campaign finance. In other words, he's sort of hiding the ball. What is the thing that makes this a serious case? Point is that, you know, a Republican could say this looks awfully political if this is the best you can do.
I appreciate how you started with what Sarah Isgur has been saying. And just to underscore what you said, she's got an interesting background herself, right? You mentioned that she was a spokeswoman at the Department of Justice in the Trump administration. Previous to that, she wasn't actually a supporter of Trump. I think she was on the campaign, or at least aligned herself with Carly Fiorina. But so a criticism coming from her, have given her DOJ experience, you know, it might be something to consider further. But let me ask you, though. The fundamental critique of a prosecution being political is, you know, it implies that the legal process itself, right, the machinery of the justice system in any case that has to do with a politician is by default going to be political. And so that's basically saying you just can't trust the justice system when it comes to alleged crimes committed by people who have been elected by the American people.
Yes, it does. And I'm not saying that I believe any of this. But this is, she's saying, this is the, if you want to understand why Republicans believe Trump when he says they're after me, these are ginned up. They didn't announce these prosecutions until I had announced I was running for president. Isn't that a coincidence? Why? Well, because they want to stop me from becoming president. And Trump would say, look at these, witch hunt. And then he says, you know, it's a banana republic where an incumbent president prevents opposition from developing by prosecuting a rival in a campaign. So this is the mentality of, you might say, is it paranoia? Is it persecution? Or is it the kind of warranted skepticism that any Democrat might feel if the shoe were on the other foot?
Good point. Well, to that, I would also say, though, that, a prosecution doesn't just magically happen and land in as an active court case. It has to go through a grand jury, which it did. All of these go through grand juries who then hand down indictments.
Well, yes. But, famously, prosecutors could indict a ham sandwich through a... This is so telling. In a study of about 10 years ago of the Justice Department, noted there were something like 160,000 submissions to grand juries by the U.S. Justice Department. And out of those 160,000, juries said no to the indictment 11 times.
Wow.
So that's even, it's almost 100%. It's 99.9%. The point is, that's sophistry. So it's a jury of his peers. We all know what grand juries are like. So that's not necessarily a guarantor of probable cause. What it is, it shows that prosecutors can pretty much get what they want out of grand juries.
Yeah. So Jack, you're coming with the receipts, which I really appreciate. And I was wondering when a ham sandwich would make its presence known in this conversation. But I don't know, maybe I'm playing the role of defending the legal system in the United States, even with all of its imperfections. Because perhaps the reason why that grand jury indictment rate is so, so lopsided is because it's not actually a trial, right? The grand jury doesn't determine guilt or innocence. It just determines the worthiness of charges that the prosecutor wants to bring. I mean, I don't know if that is an effective rebuttal to the ham sandwich argument, but to me, it takes a little bit of the political sting out of it.
Yes, I quite agree. I quite agree. On the other hand, if someone submitted this about the Soviet Union in the past or Russia today, it would say, wait a minute, that sounds like a really rigged system. And of course, in Russia, it's convictions. Nevertheless, it's a statistic that can't comport with ideas, a priori ideas of fairness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Jack, the point that you're making, though, Donald Trump and his supporters go even further, right? Basically, what they say, it's not just it's political. They'll frequently say it's Joe Biden's Justice Department that is bringing these charges and timing them according to the election calendar, really just drawing it straight back to the White House, with the implication that the Justice Department is nothing but a marionette, and the hand really at work here is the current president's.
Yes, and people cite that. They say, my gosh, we all know the Justice Department is separate, and there's a whole post-Watergate protocol limiting the contact between the White House and the Justice Department. But here's what one scholar of the relation between White Houses and Justice Departments, here's the way he puts it. The Attorney General is obliged to serve two masters. He's the president's personal and political advisor, yet he's also responsible for the ideal of nonpartisan, even-handed justice. Time and again, these two functions collide with each other head on. That there is a conflict between the Attorney General's loyalty to the law and to the presidency. And in a Yale law article called Too Close for Comfort, An Insider's View of Presidents and Their Attorneys General, One scholar gives a quick look at modern history of very close relations between AGs and presidents. Famously, Robert F. Kennedy called him, called himself my brother's wingman. His Justice Department was, she writes, frankly political, and the Attorney General viewed the 93 U.S. attorneys as his field officers, charged with prosecuting his brother's enemies. LBJ used the FBI to spy on anti-war protesters, on congresspeople, on journalists. And then, of course, Nixon, I mean, John Mitchell, his first attorney general, was sentenced to 2 to 8 years for his role in Watergate. His second attorney general, Richard Kleindienst, perjured himself before Congress, covering up Nixon's effort to interfere in a antitrust case to help a political donor. And, of course, subsequently, we've seen other scandals in the Justice Department. But in the wake of Watergate, Sam Ervin, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee looking into Watergate, in the middle of those hearings, he had a 2 days, I believe, of hearings about whether the Justice Department, because of this kind of history of being the president's sword and shield, whether the Justice Department should be taken out of the executive branch altogether and lodged as part of the judiciary. And he had scholars come before him and say, give their views. The balance of views seemed to be, no, what we need is character in the people that the president appoints. We need good character. It's not the system, it's not the structure, it's the character of the people. Well, you know, character didn't save the Justice Department from subsequently being disgraced by Ed Meese, who was President Reagan's attorney general, for interfering in all kinds of cases benefiting the president's campaign contributors. And certainly character didn't prevent William Barr under President Trump from serving as, his just really giving him anything he wanted, from clearing out, Lafayette Park so that the president could walk across the street and brandish the Bible in front of the church, to interfering in the Roger Stone investigation, on, and such that over 1,000 former officers of the Justice Department called for his resignation. He was a disgracefully abject sword and shield of President Trump.
You know, I take your point, Jack, because executive appointees serve at the pleasure of the president, right? I mean, they are appointed. They have to be confirmed, of course, but they're presidential appointees. But on the other hand, I wonder what an alternative system might look like. You put it in the judiciary, then how would we choose an attorney general, right? I mean, this is all theoretical because, as you said, after those 2 days of Ervin hearings, I don't think this idea has ever been taken seriously. But so here's my respectful pushback, Jack, okay? When it comes to the myriad examples that you gave of just overt times where the attorney general even just kind of admitted that they were acting for the benefit of the president of the United States. Do we possibly also have a kind of confirmation bias here? Because that ignores the thousands and thousands of cases that go through the Justice Department that never receive the same sort of criticism because they are just normal cases that have to be prosecuted at the federal level.
Right. We don't have the counterfactual, and there are uncertainly, many, the evidence is overwhelming that normal business goes on. The point is, these are very, very critical moments. Mm-hmm. The Justice Department has huge powers, and it has unassailable, unchallengeable a discretion in what cases to bring. That's an extraordinary power in our system. And I just point to evidence, what scholars point to, of cases where justice departments have pretty much done what their president wanted them to do. And this is where we're headed. Donald Trump says, there's an unwritten rule not to prosecute former presidents and political rivals, he said last year. He said, I will appoint a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of America, Joe Biden, and the Biden crime family. In other words, he's going to use his Justice Department as a sword against Joe Biden, as Joe Biden is using it against him. And Trump has said, in addition, he said, I will jail Liz Cheney. John Kerry should be prosecuted. Adam Schiff needs to be questioned for treason. James Comey should, quote, face years in jail. John Bolton should go to jail. Trump is ready to use the powers of the Justice Department as a bloody sword slicing through American law. And on the other side of it, we have a dictatorship. What he wants to do with the Justice Department is to essentially turn it into a star chamber to prosecute anybody he doesn't like. That's dictatorship. That's the end of the rule of law. And we have to say, would it have happened? Could he have used the Justice Department if the Sam Irvin Road had been taken? If the Justice Department had been separated from the president? We'll never know. I hope we don't have to test that proposition.
Well, there is the heart of today's jackpot, right, Jack? That criticisms of the Justice Department now should be, you know, taken seriously and interrogated fairly, because it could get a whole heck of a lot worse, is what I'm hearing you say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay, so folks, Jack Potters, this is exactly what we want to hear back from you on. First of all, do you think the Justice Department is already politically compromised? I mean, can you trust the kind of prosecutions and cases, especially when they have to do with political figures, that they're being done in good faith? Just want to know that. And if your answer is no, what alternative system would you propose? And do you have concerns about what Jack just said, that the politicization and the weaponization of the Justice Department could potentially get immeasurably worse under a second Trump administration? So grab your phones. I know a lot of you already have the On Point Vox Pop app on your phone. So let us know what you think. For those folks who are, let's call them lurking jackpot listeners, who listen every week but don't think that they have anything to say, I issue you a friendly challenge. Like, if you're from Texas or Arizona, someplace like that, we haven't heard from jackpotters in those places. Well, not often enough, at least. Let us know what you think about the Justice Department. Go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop. So looking forward to that. And by the way, Jack, jackpotters, as we know, they always will have their say, right? And they do so in the treasured spirit of passionate but civil disagreement. So here's one from Wisconsin.
You know, Jack, you're sounding more and more like somebody who is on the right than you are someone who rides the fence. So I'm just wondering if your research is starting to get to you.
Ooh, I'm going to let you answer that in a few minutes, Jack. But here's another one from New Jersey.
Jack is telling us exactly what is real, what is true, and people need to wake up and listen to him more.
Hear, hear. And we're going to hear more Jack Potters when we come back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, we're back. And Jack, last week, the jackpot was all about various scenarios on how to steal a U.S. presidential election. And one of them that you talked about in detail was intimidation at the ballot box. And we got several jackpotters who had some responses to that, because they wanted to point out that that's not the only way to steal an election if you already have significantly weakened the institutions that are supposed to be the guardians of those same ballot boxes and voting booths. So let's kick off with Kyle Joyner from Helena, Montana.
Trump doesn't need people necessarily to play the role of obstructor at the ballot box. He's already got the Republican House to do that for him. Mike Johnson, it's not hard to imagine of him absolutely bending the knee and throwing it back to the states or overturning it at the congressional level. My representative, Matt Rosendale, absolutely do this. And the institutionalists, the moderates, the sober individuals in the driver's seat who were in both houses last time, most of them are gone or have been so marginalized that their voices will not be considered.
And here's Heidi Hallett from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
I think it could occur if the military and the courts went along with it. This is why legal experts and some U.S. representatives want Congress to shore up the Insurrection Act by putting a time limit on how long the military could be deployed within the U.S. without Congress's approval. Remember Trump's clashes with his multiple secretaries of defense when they resisted his bidding?
Okay, Jack, what do you think?
Well, as to Heidi's point, there's talk of that right now. The Democrats are trying to get this really ancient statute going back to the Whiskey Rebellion. It's a fuse to the end of democracy because the president has so much discretion to use force without going to Congress. And they're saying, well, no, you've got to come to Congress. The chances that Republicans are ever going to pull up that fuse, the chances are extremely slight because Trump is running on using the Insurrection Act to send the National Guard from red states into blue states to gather up, quote, illegals, immigrants without papers, and I'm sure many with, and put them in camps a la the Japanese internment. It's central, the whole idea of the Insurrection Act and giving the president all this power, it's central to what he wants to do as a dictator.
And what did you think about the other thought from Montana that, you know, House Republicans have already so vocally professed their fealty to Trump that he just doesn't trust the House to handle the election well?
Well, I saw a statement from Mike Johnson recently about democracy, and I think he said something like this. Well, we're not really a democracy. This is a republic. This is a representative system. And he went on about, you know, we can have too much talk about this democracy stuff. And, of course, what was his role in January 6th? Well, he's the one who gave the permission structure to his colleagues, 140 of them, to essentially reject the election on the most spurious grounds, this fantastical lawsuit pursued by Republican attorneys general to, where Texas would say, no, what Pennsylvania has done is wrong. There was no even basis for such a lawsuit, and the Supreme Court dismissed it, but he gave that sophistry. And is he ready to spin more sophistry on Trump's behalf? No one who looks at how completely he's given over to Trump could regard that question with any hope.
Mm. You know, one of these days, soon I hope, I want to do a show about the difference between a constitutional republic and a democracy and why. I mean, we get a lot of emails, I have to say, I do personally, from listeners who say, no, we are a constitutional republic and not a democracy. And I want to know why that distinction, who's decided to drive that back into U.S. politics. So maybe we'll do that show someday in the near future. But back to feedback from the Jack Potters out there. Here is our man, Howard Turner, with the view from, well, I was going to say the view from Elkhart, but he keeps telling us that he's not exactly representative of his area. So Howard, today I will say Howard Turner, the man with a view from Elkhart, Indiana.
There are two reasons to do all of this besides the obvious of electing Trump is to sow as much distrust and confusion as possible. As the more that people distrust the system, the less that people will vote, which is the main goal, reducing who votes. Just look at the number of people already that don't vote just because they don't believe their vote matters because nothing changes or that no one represents them.
By the way, Jack, Howard also said that as soon as he finished sending us that message, he's going to go to register to be a poll worker or poll observer in order to do his part to protect the process where he lives. So what do you think about that?
That's what Howard is, a model citizen in more ways than one. He raises all the questions, and it's generating fear. That's Trump's métier. Fear of violence, fear of the government persecuting you. Fear is the ocean he swims in. And as with all dictators before they got to office, that's what they run on. That's the fuel. And so it touches voting. And if people can, if it makes people think their vote doesn't matter, if it makes people think going to the polls is dangerous, he's all for that. And fear wins.
Mm, okay. So, Jack, by the way, sometimes you do episodes that are so provocative, people can't stop thinking about them. And your episode about missing misery, that one about how the consumer price index doesn't really reflect how expensive life has become because it doesn't adequately include the cost of money in it. We are still getting Jack Potters talking to us about that. And this week, a listener named Kyler Farr from North Bend, Washington, I think he sent us three messages at least, Kyler. And in one of them, he really, really did his homework. I'm so impressed by this. He went back and found the paper that you were referencing that was co-authored by Larry Summers that talked about the missing misery and the lack of accounting for the cost of money. And Kyler read the whole thing, top to bottom, okay? And he told us that actually he doesn't disagree with the overall thrust of the paper, that perhaps CPI is not an adequate measure, but he felt really strongly that it's not so much missing the cost of money that's the issue, but that the fundamental basis for CPI is flawed. And so therefore, he wanted to add this, that here's why he thinks that the cost of money should not be considered in inflation calculations.
It should not, because CPI as a tool is what the Federal Reserve uses to measure inflation. And what is the Federal Reserve's tool to fight inflation? It is to increase the cost of money. So right there in and of itself, it should be excluded, right? Because if the Federal Reserve is going to fight inflation, and every time they hike interest rates, it looks like inflation as measured by CPI is going up, that is, you know, it's like trying to lose weight and you start, you know, going to the gym and lifting weights, but every time you get on the scale, you're still holding the 25-pound dumbbell and you think you're gaining weight. It just wouldn't make any sense.
Okay, Jack, so I will admit I graciously tip my hat to Kyler because I think that's a pretty solid counter-argument. And I step back from my – I was very, very enthusiastic and be like, yeah, this is wrong. We should account for the cost of money. But what do you think?
Well, there's a wonderful reductio ad absurdum about that, isn't there? but maybe the Fed should, because after all, if we have an official inflation rate, and we have a sort of felt inflation, and then we find out from Summers et al. That the felt inflation, which is bringing in the cost of money, corresponds to something real. Oughtn't that be part of what the Fed is thinking about?
Yeah. You know, Jack, I actually think in a sense there's a solution that both satisfies Kyler's concern about conflating numbers, which are actually, you know, they're not independent variables when it comes to inflation. And your very, very accurate observation that we don't have a measure for felt inflation, right? Because, you know, there's that that sort of scientific adage of you only value what you can measure. And then and you only make conclusions based on what you can measure, but it may not actually be all the information that you need because you're just not measuring the other information. So I would say, you know, maybe Kyler's right. Like, keep the cost of money out of the CPI, all right? Because if the Fed does use the CPI to determine, you know, how it wants to use its levers to control inflation, you can't mix the two variables. But maybe I also think what you're saying is exactly right. We need a whole new index, right? Why don't we create a felt inflation index? So one of them, the CPI, is a policy index used for policy making. A felt inflation index could be, you know, just sort of a reality check index on what impact is this having on the American people. I don't see a problem with that. And if there are any like economist types around Washington that are hearing this, give it a thought. So,
amen. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I just want to mention, we had a caller from Wisconsin before the break, and I just didn't jot down his name.
Oh, I'm going to get to him.
I apologize.
Oh, Jack.
Yes.
Don't you worry.
All right.
Because he's the last one coming up here.
All right.
Okay. So his name is John Walshlager from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And interestingly, his overall comment really ties together the two things we were just talking about the economy, cost of living now, and his concerns about the democratic integrity of this country. So what John basically says is that he strongly feels that America is becoming a two-class society, two classes only, rich and poor, and that the middle class is being systematically cut down, which is creating dangerous stresses on our political system.
I kind of share that. Okay, I just paid about 30% more for ink cartridges for my printer that I bought in September that I just got in March. It's corporate greed, okay? And corporate greed, of course, many of the people in the corporations that are making decisions are in that upper class, okay? So they're making decisions that don't affect them directly, and that makes them dangerous. And so we are headed, to me, towards that two-class society. And we only need to look to a few other countries around the world and see where that takes us.
John's also the man who had that comment about his perception of your political leanings, which we'll get to in a second. But first of all, what do you think about his linking here of the plight of the middle class to the, the election concerns that you raised in the last jackpot?
Well, I think people are, he used the word frayed and even frantic. I think that the whole notion of middle class just doesn't have the valence that it used to have. I mean, it meant something solid, and there was aspiration built into it. But really, since the Reagan years, the aspiration has seemed to be sort of pointless. You're never going to get rich, so that the chance to get up seems a steeper climb. And on the other hand, the trap door below looks awfully ready to swing open at any moment. I mean, serious medical issue, car accident, dental problems, you name it. So the insecurity of the middle class haunts our whole society and certainly our politics. And, the other point that John was making, that the rich are not like you and me. Isn't that the Hemingway line? And Fitzgerald says, one of them says, yeah, they got more money. But they aren't like you and me. Look at the rich. Look at the billionaires now around Trump. There have been quotations of what these people said, several of them, right after January 6th. Oh, this Trump is no good. He's a potential dictator. We're never going to give him any money. And there they were down there in Mar-a-Lago shelling out the big bucks. And why? Well, he's going to cut our taxes. They're bought. There's a mordant saying of Marx's, the capitalist is capital personified. That is, there's no morality. There's no person there. It's just capital speaking through a human being. And boy, when you look at these billionaires, I think of that Marx comment, the capitalist is capital personified.
Well, Jack, I wonder what John thinks about you quoting Marx just now, because he's also the guy, a little earlier, but we're going to play it again, he's also the guy who wondered this.
Jack, you're sounding more and more like somebody who is on the right than you are someone who rides the fence. So I'm just wondering if your research is starting to get to you.
Go ahead,
John, Jack.
It probably is. I ride the fence. I'm a mugwump. My mug is on one side of the fence and my wump is on the other.
Jack. That is the most gracious response that anyone could have come up with. I was prepared to put my flak jacket on and duck, actually. But you see, this is why we all listen to the Jackpod, for both your intelligence, your analysis, and your true gentlemanly style, Jack. So thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the Jackpod from On Point.